Hi, welcome to our album.
Bruce Wingate, was there any incident in your childhood you often find yourself reflecting on that has affected the person you are now?
When I was a little kid, there's a grand opening of a bank in town, and my dad took me there. I guess they were going to have like a magician and this and that. And it was back when banks were still friendly, and when they weren't all Bank of America. And a new bank opening was sort of welcomed in town. So this new bank opened, my dad took me there, and I remember there being like cups of free high C and some sort of snack treats or whatever. But the killer was this. There was a monkey there. There's a monkey there on roller skates. And not only was this monkey on roller skates, but he smoked cigars. And I remember being a little kid, and this monkey skating right up to me and looking me in the eye. And that's when I knew I wanted to be in show business.
Welcome to episode 12 of Jughead's Basement, featuring Adrenaline OD's 1986 second full-length release of Humongous Fungus Among Us, on the very own record label, Buy Our Records. Adrenaline OD formed in 1981 from the ashes of a few other New Jersey suburban punk bands. They went on to record four full-length records, a handful of 7-inches, and a plethora of vinyl and cassette compilations before calling it quits in 1989. In the 80s, Adrenaline OD, also known as AOD, were compilation kings with hardcore songs alongside early recordings of Beastie Boys, Bad Brains, White Flag, Minutemen, 7 Seconds, Naked Ray Gun, and The Adolescents. AOD were a crucial yet often overlooked influence on the DIY music which spawned such bands as Screeching Weasel, NoFX, and even Anthrax. Their song Paul's Not Home was covered by Jack White and Gibby Haynes of White Stripes and Butthole Surfers fame.
Hello, Mrs. Richard. Is Paul home?
What the hell?
Put that house! Put that house! Put that house! Get this one out! Out of the way! At least I don't know that! Oh, put this jam! Yeah, I know!
I would not be amiss in saying that AOD had a stronger beginning influence on Screeching Weasel, more so than the Ramones, in musical stylings, antics, and image. And as always, this podcast will be presented to you in order of the songs as they appear on Humongous Fungus Among Us, interspersed with sections of interviews of all Adrenaline OD band members appearing on Humongous Fungus Among Us, including singer-guitarist Paul Richards, bassist Jack Steeples, drummer Dave Scott, and guitarist Bruce Wingate. You will also hear interviews with AOD pal, fellow musician, and label representative Lenny Splendorio, along with a written audio piece by Jersey Beat creator, journalist, musician, and podcaster Jim Testa. And now I am proud to present Adrenaline OD's Humongous Fungus Among Us. Paul Richards, you are the guitarist and vocalist for AOD. What influenced you to pick up a guitar?
What made me want to pick up guitar was Ritchie Blackmore and the Machine Head album by Deep Purple.
Me too, actually. I had a big poster of Ritchie Blackmore on my wall.
There's something about that just, who can explain why, but that it spoke to me, we'll say. It was my sister's album. I guess I was like 11 or 12 or something, and I just kind of appropriated that over to my room and wore it out. Then I started taking, I took a year of West Tunes, I think when I was 13. The following year or whatever, I got some bad grades, so my mother said, you can't play anymore, no more lessons. And so I just picked up the rest on my own from there.
Did those sort of influences, like that, those bands actually get you into like playing in a band, or did it take some other type of music style?
I guess, not being an exceptionally good guitarist, I really couldn't see myself starting a Deep Purple cover band, let's put it that way. I guess it would be the do-it-yourself, anybody can do it kind of attitude of punk rock. That would have push me. Hey, I can do that.
Track 1, AOD versus Son of Godzilla.
Paul, as the band speed was getting faster and faster, was it hard to sing and get the words to actually be words?
I just pulled out Humongous Fungus and I was going over the lyrics. Anyway, how the hell did all that come out of my mouth? And I'm looking at some of the lyrics like, I never said that. There's the chorus in Survival. Like, that's not what I sang. It's
was it difficult? For some things, for instance, like Son of AOD versus Godzilla, even the original AOD versus Godzilla, those weren't meant to be instrumentals. It was just, it was too hard to play and try to sing something. It just stayed as an instrumental at that point. Yeah, for the most part, it's just gibberish. Yeah, who could, no one could understand.
Yeah, I put that on my list because I actually listened to the, I was listening to a bunch of clips and I found the one for, Gilman Street in California. It was so damn fast that your lyrics were just, it was just like a wall of consonants and vowels.
Yeah. Yeah, and I look back and I think, what the hell are we doing?
Paul, where were you born and raised?
I was born in East Orange, New Jersey. Spent, I guess, the first 12 years of my life in Irvington, New Jersey, then another 12 or so in Union, and basically Northeast New Jersey is where I spent my life. I was a guitar player, and I have no idea why I decided, like, hey, I want to sing. I don't know what the hell I was thinking at the time. And so I just started singing. Eventually, I wanted to, you know, play guitar a little more. So we started working in some songs. I played guitar. It's something I didn't know that I could do. Just thinking about it seemed like something very difficult, but I was able to do it easily. So I took it rather well, and like every band I get into, since then, I always wind up having to sing again, but I really don't like doing it. But no one would let me stop.
You were actually singing in one of the bands before it became Adrenaline OD, is that correct?
No, I was playing guitar, and that was East Patterson Boys Choir, where we all met before. Bruce was actually the singer in that one.
Bruce, where were you born and raised?
Born in right outside of Newark, New Jersey, and grew up in the suburbs of Patterson. My folks were from... Dad is from Patterson, my mom was from Passaic. Mom actually went to school with the Shirelles.
This is dedicated to the one I love.
Folks retired and moved to Florida because that's the law when you're from New Jersey. So that's where they're at now. Dad was a cop for 26 years. Hence my lifelong friendship with White Flag.
So your father was a policeman?
Yeah, he was. Yep. He started out as a patrol cop, and then he ended up becoming a record bureau photographer guy. So we would get phone calls in the middle of the night, and I would have to go wake him up to take pictures of God knows what. So that was kind of made for awesome dinner table conversation. It made for good interview questions, too, because people would always, you know, ask about me and the cops, and, you know. One of the standard 80s interview questions, do you have any trouble with the cops? And I'd be like, yeah, they're always making me clean my room and trying to get me to take the garbage out and sleeping with my mom.
Track 2, Office Buildings.
That is a more serious song, I guess. And at the time in New Jersey, there was a big building boom. And pretty much any open area was bulldozed. And like either townhouses went up or office complex, and was really, I don't know if it was properly thought out. Being a big fan of nature myself, I didn't like seeing it. I guess that was my reaction to that.
Bruce, what influenced you to be in a punk band?
Well, I mean, I always enjoyed music even when I was a kid. My older brother sort of steered me toward the cool stuff. So, you know, like I was into the Stones, early Alice Cooper, Alice the Band, not Alice the Man. And I even used to play Altamont with my toy soldiers because we would watch Gimme Shelter every year. It was on PBS, and this left me using a shoebox as a stage. And I'd have hippies on one side and Hell's Angels on the other, and I'd make them fight. And then, you know, when I, my brother moved away, by then he got me in, like I say, into the cool stuff like Slade. The very first record I owned was Meet the Chipmunks and Alice Cooper. So if you just combine all three of those, that pretty much leads straight to punk rock in its own way. I have to say, you know, it's a complete stereotype, but the ground zero for me was Rocket to Russia. That was the one where just by then I had owned several crappy acoustic guitars that I couldn't really play. And I think I might have already had an electric guitar by that point. And then I bought this Ramones record, and within, like, you know, a couple months, I could play from top to bottom and can even add other parts to it that make it sound even better. So, but yeah, I mean, that was it. I just gravitated right toward it. I think right when I really started making a little headway of learning how to play was right when we really discovered all that punk rock stuff at the same time. There were probably about maybe only four or five of us in high school that we all found it at the same time, and we were all friends, and then that was it. We would just feed off each other. Each person would buy a new record, and we all go hear it and everything, and it's funny because there are a few bands from that time frame that still continued on to have an influence. Because you think about a lot of the bands that sort of made the jump between punk and hardcore, and a lot of times people forget they're two separate events for a lot of people, you know? You know, I went from rock music to punk rock, and then the hardcore. It wasn't one seamless thing, you know? And there were some people who didn't really quite make the jump. They were into punk rock, they weren't into hardcore. But the same way with a lot of the bands, like you know, the first time I heard the Dead Kennedys, as far as I knew, they were a punk rock band. Same thing for the Dickies, same thing for the Misfits, you know. And a lot of those bands ended up still, you know, playing for hardcore audiences or sort of becoming associated with both genres.
Paul, track number three, written by you, Yuppie.
Also at the time was the whole gentrification thing going on in New York. I went to see Jerry Rubin, who was originally a Yippie with Ed Kaufman, and then he decided, hey, you know, money's okay, and he was the proselytizing for the Yuppies. And I went to see a lecture, and it did not come off very well. It was just basically, you know, the whole greed is good kind of Wall Street thing, and I didn't appreciate that. I didn't appreciate what was going on, I guess, in the Lower East Side at that particular time. And I guess that's my response to that also.
Jack, where were you born and raised?
Oh, Jersey. Mostly lived in and around Paterson, New Jersey.
Your whole life, huh?
Pretty much, my whole life.
What did that have for you, Jersey, Paterson, New Jersey?
Paterson doesn't have much. My parents were, like, born and raised in Paterson. So it's the third largest city in New Jersey. That doesn't mean too much because Jersey really doesn't have too many large cities. I actually lived in the projects in Paterson for 5 years growing up. I went to seven different schools, got married when I was 18, became a father when I was 18. I'm still married and still a father and a grandfather too.
So you were doing a lot of this touring and traveling and playing while you were a father.
Yes, indeed. You know, sometimes, you know, some of the money would help with the bills. You know, not that we made a lot of money, but I didn't make a lot of money working either, so I need a little bit of help. Probably what influenced me to pick up the guitar was friends of mine who actually played the guitar. Because back when, you know, I was younger, punk rock really wasn't popular, and I didn't really hear punk rock. You heard, like, progressive rock and stuff like that. I thought, ah, shit, I'll never be able to play that, you know? Punk rock really made it accessible. But if you really want to play like everybody who's actually playing, they really want to do it because they got to put in the effort and go through the pain. So I think I was more influenced by people around me than anybody in a band or anybody famous. Probably the three people that influenced me the most were actually Bruce Wingate, Dom Kaprowski, also known as Tommy K from Bedlam and Morning Noise, and Paul Richard from AOB.
In the band, you're a bass player. Do you consider yourself a bass player or just a guitarist who plays bass?
Well, at first I was a guitar player. Bruce was starting a band. He needed a bass player, so I got a bass. And I played bass for, you know, a while, but I always played guitar, too. And when I left AOD, I actually started playing guitar for Mental Decay, and actually I still do now. I just like to play. I don't consider myself a bass player or a guitar player. I'm a guy who owns a bass and owns a guitar.
Bruce, the song Answer.
I really don't know how that came about. All I know is that sort of open chord plucking the strings thing. I know I stole that from someone. Sort of like a Generation X. That up a little bit in some ways. I think it was our first philosophical AOD song.
Yeah, I was noticing the slight more self-analyzing in that song more than the others.
Yeah, a little bit. I don't know, I was probably reading Siddhartha or something like that, who knows? Or is trying to get laid. I don't know, man.
There's a song that Husker Du does that Grant Hart wrote. So there's something about that reminds me of that sort of self-analyzing.
That's funny, too, because I never thought about that in those terms, but I'm good friends and still playing a band with Todd Knapp from 76, and obviously, you know, we have a lot of ground to cover whenever we talk about anything, and we always discuss that whole period in hardcore where it sort of turned back at itself, became self-reflective, and you'd started hearing songs about the scene itself and sort of self-realization and all that. And all that was about 86 or so, if you really think about it.
Dave, where were you born and raised?
I was born in Passaic, New Jersey, and raised in the neighboring town of Clifton, which is about 15 minutes outside of New York City. Sprawling suburban white trash slums.
It sounds like you're all from slightly different white trash slums.
Yeah, kind of. Jack and Bruce's white trash slums were a little more crowded. I grew up in a garden apartment with, like, you know, a lot of kids, so it was kind of cool. And then when my grandparents died, we moved two blocks up to a house that they had owned. And that's where I lived from, like, you know, 13 to about 18.
There's a lot of hardcore bands that I have a hard time listening to. I mean, even putting 7 seconds up there, a lot of it is that it just sounds like snare, 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 you know, when it gets that fast.
Right.
But for some reason, yours doesn't. I don't know if you mix it up a little bit more, or it doesn't sound like that to me, that it becomes an annoying sort of just like pounding sound.
Well, I could tell you what I did different, that there weren't a lot of bands doing back then, and if you've ever heard of that, like, D beat that, like, a lot of those bands use, like, we would call that the cheat beat. And for every, like, a fast beat these bands were playing, they would hit hi-hat and bass at the same time, and then snare. And they could play really fast like that. But I started off playing hi-hat, bass, hi-hat, snare. And just playing that one beat over and over again until it got faster and faster and faster. So for every one beat that all these, you know, self-proclaimed thrash bands and most of the metal bands were playing, I was playing double what they were playing on my hi-hat. There's a certain feel to it. There's only a few drummers back then that were doing it, like the drummer for DRI actually played the right beat, and the drummer for 76% Uncertain, who's an excellent drummer, he played it right. But everybody else kind of did it that cheapy, you know, and it's like, well, you can play really fast like that, but it really is sloppy, and it just falls the hell apart, if you ask me. And there was a certain coherence, and you always had that thump crash, you know, and I just learned to do that same beat as fast as I could possibly play it. There were times where we were so fast, we would play one of the faster songs, like World War IV, or Fuck the Neighbors, and we would look at each other and just give each other that nod, like, okay, well, let's race to the end, you know? And we try to outplay each other, you know? It was almost a game to us.
Jack, track number 5 is one of my favorites, Pope on a Rope. I love this song because it has a great balance between speeding fast hardcore and great melodic rhythms.
I like that music too. And when I wrote that music, I'm like, wow, people are going to love this fucking song. And I thought, this is fucking great. I love this. People are going to dig this. You know, I kind of moved the words because Dave wrote the lyrics, gave me the lyrics. I kind of moved the lyrics around so it fit. I'm like, wow, this is going to be great. But people like Bugs better, which I also wrote the music to. And if you listen, the music is kind of similar, which goes to show I don't have much of imagination.
Pope on a Rope, I think, came across with me seeing a chocolate cross for sale at a local store. And I thought, what would Jesus say if he saw a chocolate cross? Just being able to capitalize on religion the way people were doing it. I wasn't religious in any way, but I just thought that it was kind of hypocritical to, you know, sell God or have these, you know, merchandise Jesus like Gene Simmons would merchandise Kiss. I think it predated the Meat Men song of the same name, for that matter. I mean, if you're really religious, does that chocolate cross speak to you? Just the absurdity of it. That's where, you know, the Pope on a Rope, there was soap on a rope at the time. So it was just another marketing item.
There you mention Jerry Falwell, which is another time capsule description for me, because I think me and Ben used to watch that. What was the fascination with, like, punks watching that?
When you say, Lord, I cannot anymore. I've gone the last step. I can't do it. I've tied the last knot. He never gives strength for tomorrow. He only gives strength for the moment.
I mean, there's a certain entertainment value and absurdity value to it. And I think that it's really the same kind of attraction that we would have had to watching professional wrestling when we used to when we were kids. You know, and the AOD was real into that. We would go to, like, wrestling matches and root for the Iron Sheik and piss people off just to be assholes. You know, we'd always root for the bad guy. If there was a Russian, it's like, USSR, USSR. And I think that that absurd fascination with lowbrow, quasi-entertainment, I mean, you know, somebody like that's asking for millions of dollars from his followers really could give a shit about religion, lining pockets. And I think that I've always been into hypocrisy. You know, there were so many good evangelists back in the 70s and 80s. I mean, they were like the fire and brimstone types. There's still a couple of them on TV, and I still even watch a few to this day just because they're so damn nutty. Nuttier than Fruitcake, man.
Paul, number 6 on the record was Fishing Musician.
Yeah. Jack and I are big fishermen, still are, were back then. The main riff for that is actually, I won't say stole, but borrowed or took from a friend. So, you know, hey, you know, it's a cool riff. Mind if I use it? And he didn't remember ever doing it. I wrote that, really? He's kind of like, well, okay, maybe I did write it, and I just don't remember it that way. So I took that riff, put it into a song, and the second riff, I believe I stole from, I had a cassette of, like, Renaissance songs or something, and had a little riff that sounded cool and fit right in there.
Well, the first person I met from Adrenaline OD, but he wasn't an original member, was Bruce Wingate. I went to high school with Bruce.
The first band I was in, we were called The Executives, very original name. And the only other person of note that anyone might have heard of is
Tommy Kaprowski, who would go out to Morning Noise and Bedlam.
Tommy Kaprowski, who was also in Bedlam, he was in Morning Noise.
Tommy, who would later go on to Morning Noise and Bedlam.
Tommy Kaprowski, I think, was in it, too.
He's always been floating in and out of the buyer record scene, and I grew up with him. He's one of those guys we discovered the Ramones together with. I was a bass player, he was a guitar player. And we just did a whole bunch of punk rock covers, really, with that band.
Stooges, Dead Boys, Heartbreakers.
And then after that, we started this other band, which is where everything for AOD fell into place. We had a band called East Patterson Boys Choir.
We actually started the East Patterson Boys Choir, me and Bruce. And we started trying to get shows. We got a show at this little place next to the Capitol Theater in Passaic, New Jersey. Now, the Capitol Theater was a big theater where you're seeing, like, big-name bands. I went to my first concert there. I saw Rush. We got a show there, and the night we played, Jack Bruce and friends played at the fucking Capitol Theater. In a white room with black curtains. With the Good Rats. Now, you got to remember, this is like 1980, and if you were a punk rocker walking down the street, you know, like me, I had my hair bleached, people would yell shit at you. People would want to kick the shit out of you just for being a punk rocker. People wanted to fucking kill you. So here we are, we're playing next to the Capitol Theater with Jack Bruce and his fucking friends. The drums are in the storefront window, and there's a big line to get into the theater, and they're banging on the window saying, punk rock sucks, and I'm giving them the finger. Oh, it was a lot of fun. But actually, when we were rehearsing for that show at that place, there was a place across the street called Two Tone, which was a punk shop. They had punk clothes and records and all kinds of stuff. And that's where we first met Dave Scott.
They were playing this little cafe, and I walked in on their rehearsal and sat down. They were doing covers of, like, Saturday Night by the Bass and Rollers, and I think Sonic Reducer, and mostly covers. But, they was like the first punk rock band I actually got to sit down and watch, and I talked to them all afterwards, and I was like, wow, you guys are great, man. Let me bring, some people from my school to check out your show. You know, they had the gig there that weekend. I brought some people down, and I struck up a friendship with them, and then ended up becoming their manager at like 14 years old.
Dave's a couple years younger than me. He had to be 14 or 15.
But he wanted to be our manager. We thought he was in his 20s, but we didn't realize he was only 16 years old. And that's how good of a shyster he was. He got over on all of us. Oh, this guy's going to book his gigs. Or find out, wait a minute, you're still in high school?
And he kind of hung around the band. And that summer, we got a couple of audition shows, one at CBGB's, another one at a place called The Showplace that was in Jersey. Well, the East Patterson Boys Choir, I think one of the guitar players left. Bruce put an ad in this paper called The Aquarian, which was like this musician's paper. It listed a bunch of shows that were going on, and in the back was like classifieds where musicians could find each other and shit like that. So Bruce put an ad in there, and Paul answered it.
So I called him up. We set up a meeting, and I was going over to Jack's living room. They had drum set up and amplifiers and stuff.
And we used to rehearse at my house in the living room. So every weekend I would move the furniture out of the living room, which my mother loved. But she was cool enough to let us, practice there. So Paul answered the ad, and me and Bruce were doing our weekly ritual where we'd move all the equipment out of his room, walk it up the street to my house, and set up the living room.
And I was kind of lost trying to find the house when I saw these two punks walking down the street carrying a guitar amp. I was like, one of you guys, Jack? He was like, yeah, that's me.
So a guy comes up the street in his Dodge Duster. It was white with a black vinyl roof. And he pulls up to us, and he's like, hey, you Bruce. And, he's seen us carrying the equipment and stuff. And it was Paul. And I could just remember, I'm looking at him like, man, this fucking dude looks like a serial killer. Because he had like this weird smile and shit. He came up to the house and we started playing. And we were just playing cover tunes mostly at the time.
They're looking for a guitarist into Stooges, Dead Boys, Heartbreakers, which is, that's what I did.
He knew all the fucking songs, like lick for lick. He just came in and he turned his amp up really fucking loud. Like, man, this dude is great. He wants to play with us, and he did. Yeah, that summer we played like the Clifton City Picnic, which was fun. That was some outdoor show at the Clifton. Dave actually got us that show, Dave Scott.
And got him a show which was pretty infamous, the Clifton City Picnic outdoors. And I still remember the guy from the picnic coming over. He's like, now you can't swear, right? I think one of the guys in the band's like, yeah, no fucking problem. No fucking problem. So they were just terrified. People still talk about that show to this day. It's kind of funny.
And eventually, after the last jock drummer left, or was kicked out, I guess, they started playing drums. And he wasn't really very good yet.
And I think I did one rehearsal, and then the band just said, okay, we're breaking up.
But it kind of fizzled out, I think, towards the end of the summer. Bruce decided to move down to Texas, I believe, where his brother was, and that's when Paul and Dave wanted to start a hardcore band.
And around that time, Dave and I were both getting into like LA's early hardcore bands, like Drums and Adolescents and Black Flags, and we decided, you know, we should be doing something like that, not playing this old crap.
We decided, hey, let's, you know, start a hardcore band. I mean, there's not really a hardcore band in New Jersey that I'm aware of. And we put an ad in the local paper, the Aquarian Weekly, and we got Jim Foster from there. And we had recruited Jack.
And then he gave me a tape. He said, hey, you want to play bass for us? And he gave me a tape, had a bunch of stuff, like The Client from a Western Civilization and Circle Jerks and stuff. And I listened to it. And at first, it was kind of foreign to me. I mean, it was a lot different than the traditional punk and a lot harder. I don't know if I liked it at first, but I couldn't stop listening to it. So I just kept listening to it over and over. It really hit home because all that fucking traditional punk, like people like the Ramones and Thunders, the stuff they were putting out wasn't really appealing to me. They were getting softer and trying to go more mainstream. The hardcore was really dark and dangerous. I went to see Black Flag when they first came to New York City at the Peppermint Lounge with Paul. And that's when they had Dez singing. And it was like, holy shit, that was fucking wild. To me, it looked like a big fight. It was cool.
So that was it. That's how we started. Paul came up with a name, Adrenaline OB.
Paul's thing was like, this is our goal. We're going to play as fast as we can for as long as we can. And that's what we did.
This was like probably like October of 81.
And that's the beginning of Adrenaline OB right there.
I thought, Bruce, that you came in a little bit later, at least on different recordings. Is that true?
I did. What had happened was this. I ended up moving to Texas with my brother for a little while. I was in Waco, Texas for about 8 months. That's when AOD formed. This is a good example of how punk rock and hardcore being separate. When I left New Jersey, everyone was listening to like Johnny Thunders. And when I got back, everyone was listening to the Bad Brains. And it was like an 8 month period. I think Jack even picked me up in Port Authority in New York, and I got in the car and we listened to the Bad Brains on the way back to New Jersey, and that was pretty much it. I had another thing going as soon as I got back to this sort of joke band called the Fartheads. But I saw AOD a bunch of times in those early days, and they were awesome. Great, great band. Jim Foster, excellent guitar player. Really, really good. And then he kind of left right when Barbecue came out, as I recall. Because I even remember one of the first things I did in the band was to help put records together. But as soon as he was gone, it was pretty much a given that I would join and take over for Jim.
I don't want to spoil the magic of it, but what is pizza and beer?
Pizza and beer. It was a disco song. In the 70s, the band was called the Silvers or something like that, Boogie Fever. And I thought it was, you know, a stupid song. It is a stupid song. But I used to make fun of it with pizza. I made up my own words and pizza and beer. For some reason, it just made it on the album. I don't know. But it was some stupid spoof on that Silver song.
Yeah, I just found it too. It's Silver spelled S-Y-L-V-E-R. And yeah, it's called Boogie Fever.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, I think one of the verses does have a pizza parlor in it. And I think I was just making fun of it one day and somehow came up with that. Why we put it on that record, I'll never know. But I tell you, I fucking regret it. Especially since I don't drink anymore and got sober. Because we do these reunion shows and people want me to fucking do this song.
Yeah, Jack, it's just one of those things. I would never even say it's like a best song, but it's one of those that really represented that punks could do whatever they wanted, and it freaked people out, and that's why I think people remember it.
We'd even go against the grain in the punk rock world.
Yeah.
The pink album covers, the fucking pink t-shirts. Oh, I pissed my pants when people would come up and like look at the fucking t-shirts and put them down. The one guy's like, I ain't wearing no fucking t-shirt with Fozzy on the back of it.
Pizza and beer. Motherfucker!
David, you wrote the lyrics for track number 6, Bugs.
Yeah.
Tell us about Bugs.
Yes. Bugs was written after I saw a Jerry Springer episode where a person thought that there was going to be an apocalypse and bugs were going to take over the world. So he was preparing for it. And the episode was so absurd and so ridiculous. And much of what we were writing at the time was based on ridiculous. And that's where Bugs came in. I really never thought that, you know, there'd be a day where, you know, big, gigantic skinheads are on stage screaming, Bugs, Bugs, you know. I mean, it's just, even to this day, you got to laugh that people get so into that song, you know. It's so absurd. It's just so ridiculous. But, you know, it was making fun of somebody that was really absurd and really ridiculous, and that's how it came across.
Okay, Bruce, tell us about the record cover of Humongous Fungus Among Us. It appears that there are two people from the band in dresses, one in a polyester suit, and you seem to be dressed as Bruce.
Maybe. I've never, you know, if you really want to get beat-a-less about it, I believe Dave and Jack are wearing their mom's house coats. And Paul was wearing some horrible polyester suit, which I guarantee you we dug out of a donation bin somewhere. I would put money on that. And then I think I was wearing someone's girlfriend's tights.
Oh, yeah, the bottom half did seem a little odd, I think.
I exerted my masculinity by wearing someone's girlfriend's tights for that photo shoot. I do believe that is our psychedelic record, though. I might even be the first psychedelic scratch records. We weren't really huge on hallucinogens, but they were in the mix at one point, and I think that played a big role in why there's flowers and the cover of the record is yellow and we're wearing women's clothing on it. So, and of course, the one thing I think we should take credit for, too, is the whole idea of being so unpunk rock that it's the ultimate punk rock thing to do. Like the way the first album was pink. Like, we laughed about that for hours. Oh, my God, it's the funniest thing. Let's make this hardcore record and make the cover, like, candy pink. And I needed T-shirts like that on one tour, too. These beautiful, like, pictures, a picture of Fonzie on the back. It said AOD. And they were bright, bright pink. So these dudes would buy them in a sweaty, darkened hall after we played. And then they'd get out in the sunlight, and all their friends would make fun of them for having pink shirts. And then they'd come back and ask if we had any other colors. And we would go, nope. So, it was so punk rock. And either people got it or people didn't get it, you know. But I think that's part of the way we're addressing those pictures, too. You know, it was pretty punk rock, you know.
Did that seep also into live performances?
Obviously it was the 80s. We all wore some stupid stuff. I would like to once again state my claim as the inventor of the paisley boxer short and combat boot look of the 1980s. I staked it out early on, and there's photographic proof that I invented it. That was one of my big looks. I enjoyed that a lot. Be hanging down on the Bowery in paisley boxer shirts with a brown paper bag with beer in it. So I really mixed signals there, you know.
I've been listening to Humongous for the past couple of weeks just to refresh my memory. And that's actually pretty cool. My favorite is Bugs, I think. That's got to be like the quintessential AOD song. It's got everything, you know, it's got the cool intro, blazing fast, stupid lyrics, got a little break in the middle. Jack's wife would call it Bugs, Bugs, Doodly Doo. Got it all. Good stuff.
Now, here's a piece that uses a few different songs written by Jersey Beat creator and journalist Jim Testa.
Loud, fast, tuneful, funny, high energy. Put together a combination like that and you can go from your first rehearsal to a headlining gig in just 6 months. Just ask Adrenaline OD. Not that AOD's right to the top of the hardcore heap was calculated or planned. The paradox of punk has always been that the music's guiding spirit of rabble-rousing anarchy clashes with the driving ambition needed to make it in the music biz. So how did AOD surface from Clifton's suburban underground to become a top New York area hardcore contender? Their approach was unique. They did it with hard work and talent. "We got a pretty clear-cut idea of what we wanted to do," said guitarist Jim Foster. "We bickered some at the start, but we're really coming together now on exactly what we want the band to sound like."
"Hey, Moe, face up!
Like a vault, look at those waves!
They're gonna give me fresh."
I'm reading there from an interview from Jersey Beat Number 2 from March of 1982, the first time I interviewed the band, right after I had just met them for the first time. Hardcore was a brand new thing in 1982. The AOD was probably the first New Jersey hardcore band I had ever seen. Maybe the first live hardcore band I'd ever seen, although obviously I'd been listening to hardcore coming over from college radio and from records from California. These guys were a little different, though. They were loud and fast, but they were really funny and really smart, and they were from New Jersey, which made them even better. Here's more of what I wrote back in 1982. "One of the nice parts of hardcore is the sense of community that the bands share. When AOD opened for Even Worse at the Silver Dollar Saloon recently, AOD, to put it politely, blew the veterans out the door. The show so impressed Even Worse's Jack Rabbit, one of the New York hardcore scene's movers and shakers, that Jack got Timmy Summer to play AOD's Paul's Not Home on his Noise the Show on WNYU and helped the band land the headlining spot at one of the Peppermint Lounge's Sunday hardcore matinees. Unlike a lot of thrash and bang hardcore, AOD extends itself beyond noise. Guitarist Jim Foster, influenced by surf rock and Link Wray, helps write AOD's energetic Sturm und Twang melodies with vocalist Paul Richard. Like many other New York, New Jersey area hardcore bands, AOD's strong point, what I think marks New Jersey, New York hardcore from the LA and DC varieties, is a wise-ass sense of street humor that comes through in songs like Mr. Rogers is a Child Molester and Old People Talk Loud. Bruce Wingate replaced Jim Foster, and the band recorded their full-length albums, The Wacky Hijinks of AOD and Humongous Fungus Among Us. I liked the band more and more. We became very good friends, and we did many, many interviews after that. But, you know, your first time is always the best. I'm Jim Testa, and that's what I think about AOD.
And now for track 9, Youth Blimp, track 10, Commercial Cuts, and track 11, Survive, we will now hear from AOD and their roles in the band, plus an introduction to Lenny Splendorio. Bruce, in terms of like internal relationship-wise or business, what would you consider your role in the band?
Agitator. Yeah, that was me. I was the agitator, drunk and unruly at inappropriate times. That was a big part of what I did. And I like to think I bought sex appeal to a band that was surely lacking any. It was really run like a democracy, actually, so that was kind of dumb of us. Really dumb of us, giving everyone an equal say. That was really stupid. We should have deferred to a higher power.
Paul.
Yeah, I was the brains of the outfit.
The brains? How so?
I guess I kind of got the whole record thing going. No one around here knew how to run a record label, so I kind of figured that out. I had a few bucks full of money that we had saved up for those shows, throwing some of my own money, found a record pressing plant by us, figured out how to get that done. We had the local high school, we had the kids in the graphic arts class make the covers. I don't know if we had any assigned roles. We just loved what we did. And if you wanted something done, you know, you had to do it. Nobody wanted to manage you or put your records about it or anything like that or book your tours. You had to do everything yourself.
Jack.
And the one thing about AOD, everybody had equal say. We all wrote songs. We all booked shows.
David.
I would guess that, you know, as close as we would have to a manager before getting a manager. Me and Paul originally started off booking shows, and then Bruce would help out. But I think the bulk of the tours, especially like the bigger ones, were me and Lenny.
Who is Lenny Splendorio?
He's the person that pretty much ran Bio Records, our record label. He brought in just about every band that got signed to it, including some of the bigger ones that got signed off the majors, like Raging Slab. And he was also the drummer for Bedlam, our like sister band back then.
MTV, music, television, even still, 24 hours of bullshit. I'm your guest DJ, Uncle Len, filling in for those douchebags.
He was our roadie on the tour in 85 that led to Humongous, so he was out there for the whole thing. And he was there for the entire recording of Humongous, like everything. Every second I was there, he was there.
Don't change that record. We'll be right back after these commercial messages.
Lenny, tell us about the formation of Bio Records and what is your involvement in that?
When AOD put out Let's Barbecue, they did it themselves, and Paul came up with the name Bio Records because it's typical his sense of humor. They put that out on their own, and we were all friends, and Jim, the singer for Bedlam, that's when they were playing, and he decided they wanted to put a record out, so it was just easy to say, okay, call it this way and make a label from there. And that's kind of the way things were actually starting.
What may not be as easy to understand, it was impossible to get distribution, get your records out. It often helped for bands to form together to start something that wasn't really a label yet, but it was just more or less a name to put under their bands under.
Yeah, well, no, because all the scenes had that. Down DC, they Discord Records. BYO in California.
What is it that will last? Let us alone. What pleasure can we have to war with evil? Is there any peace?
All the little labels like that sprouted up, so it was like it only made sense to have like a Jersey label as well. We were inspired by those at Touch and Go out of Michigan.
We're the made men!
And you suck!
Was it you're like an everyman at the label, or do you have specific duties?
We did everything, basically, from, you know, take the orders to promote it, the A&R stuff. It was me and Jim, and the A&D guys would help out. And then later on, as the label progressed, there was two other people involved as well.
Were you learning as you went? Give us a little bit of the punk aesthetic of how to run that label.
It was truly like do-it-yourself thing, and we just took from the way the other labels were run, and that's how you got involvement through Flipside, Maximum Rock and Roll. There were the connections there, but the small little distributors that you could call them yourself and ask if they'd want to sell your record on consignment. And after the Bedlam record came out and we decided it was going to be a label, then we just looked around to see what other friends, bands that we liked throughout New Jersey. And that's how we started for a while, and just all Jersey bands.
And back to me and Bruce.
I just think punk bands, especially then, that were taking on a lot more than they give themselves credit for. I know that me and Ben, for some reason, had business instincts without realizing. Like, I don't think our band would have gotten anywhere if we didn't have this sort of, we need to get out of our city, we need to do this, we need to organize.
No, that makes sense. We I think there is a sort of an innate sense of that, too, with us, where we realize that, you know, if we play somewhere last fall, we should go back there and play again in the summer, and, you know, saturate a certain area like that. Maybe we didn't really realize what we were doing, or that it was a business thing, but, like, we knew enough, like, well, this city has a great scene, and we played there, you know, over the summer we should play there again and blah 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 blah, and let's see who might have our record in that area, who's selling it, and what radio stations are there, like that kind of thing, you know. I mean, you kind of had to do that in order to maintain, you know. That's why a lot of people did, because there were a lot of fuck-ups running around back then, and I'm so glad I can keep saying fuck-ups now.
So you were a bit of a fuck ups with a little bit of business sense going there. So.
Yeah, we were fuck ups with a little bit of fuck ups with business sense. Yeah.
Lenny Splendorio with track number 12, Studio Banter.
I love actually all the stages that AOD went through. I always feel they started out, of course, Wacky Hijinks and Humongous are very like fast thrashy records, and they never lost that edge, but they got a little more polished and refined as they went along, and I'm Cruising with Elvis and even Ishtar. There's really great songs on those records. They changed a little bit, so the real hardcore stuff back then, some of the people didn't like it. I don't want to say the skinhead stuff, but you know that time of hardcore, how some of the bands, like the tough guy bands, kind of sounded. They didn't fit into that mold, and as they were getting a little slicker and even more pop-sounding, they didn't get any newer fans because I think people just wrote the band off as like a hardcore band. It was kind of a Rodney Dangerfield no respect joke that we always had.
I played hide and seek when I was three.
No respect, no respect.
Why they wouldn't even look for me.
But whenever they showed up and played, they would do their thing. And the only conflicts I think the band ever had was like tuning their guitars.
Green tune?
I mean, Humongous, when there's that little break where they're tuning up the guitars, I guess that's kind of a joke because early on when they would play, you would always give them shit. Tune your guitars, man. You guys sound fucking horrible. You're out of tune. So I think that was a little joke on us label guys and everything. Because Jim is in the background from Bio Records. You could hear him say, hey.
Paul Richards with track 13, Masterpiece. You brought in the masterpiece, right? Are you playing the lead on that, or is that Bruce that plays?
I was a big fan of classical music. Well, still am, I'm a big fan, and Bruce wanted to do part of Beethoven's Ninth also. That would be really cool. Oh yeah, and that where I ended up getting in that School of Rock movie. It's pretty amazing. I don't know if you heard that one.
That song is in School of Rock?
It's either Rock School or School of Rock, whichever one the documentary is. Going back a couple of years, somebody had sent me a link. So, dude, check this out.
From New Market Films.
He's able to bring out things in some of these kids that I don't see.
His mission.
It doesn't get any better than that.
Is to take over the world.
Rock School, it was a life-changing event.
One band at a time.
I love you. I want you to rock. I want to give you the gift of rock.
Rock School.
That was the trailer for the movie. I'm watching it. And I hear something, I'm like, oh, that's familiar. And it's Masterpiece Theater, and he has it in the soundtrack. Turns out the guy, Don, was a big fan of the band.
Crowd Control, it just says written by Bruce and you, but what is the breakdown of that?
Bruce and I believe, that's when we wrote in his room. I believe we both collaborated on the lyrics and music. We were writing the lyrics about some kind of police thing, and then I thought, was like, let's make it about, at the end, say it's a parade, you know? You know, these small-town cops are all gung-ho, because we grew up, we lived in suburbia. You get some overzealous police officers, and that's the way it kind of ended up, like overzealous police officers getting ready to keep security at a parade. Well, you know, Bruce's father was a cop. What was really fun was getting pulled over by the police with Bruce. He knew everything a cop could and couldn't do. So he'd start questioning, you know, the police officer, which they love. Oh, they love that when you fucking do that. You know, they're really happy, you know, about their job and shit like that.
Jack, I completely understand the need for humor, not only in music, but in the way we live our lives. How did the humorous nature of the band form during a time when hardcore punk tended to be overly dark and serious?
You know, we get lumped in for being a joke band, but we're not a joke band. We're more wise asses. We had a wise ass view on everything. You know, if you look at Let's Barbecue with Suburbia, it's very socially significant. But we took a wise ass way of getting our point across, you know, status symbol. And as it went on, it went from wise ass, and sometimes it got really fucking silly. Even when you go out to shows, you want to have a good fucking time. You know, and to us, joking around and laughing is a good time. We got to bust our asses at work all week and put up with shit. And when we go out, I don't want to be fucking all serious. And I ain't got nothing to preach to people. Just want to have a good fucking time. That's what we do. That's what I grew up doing. You know, busting balls and joking around and making jokes. That was my nature. And it just carried over into music. And not putting down bands that were serious or political or anything like that. But we weren't. And if we tried to do it, it would be fake. And we wouldn't be able to pull it off. You know, people would see right through that shit. So we just stayed honest to what we were. Wise asses and then downright stupid sometimes.
David, there's definitely a feel for the band of this, besides having songs that are humorous and also socio-political, there is a humor even on the stage. Like it's even said in a lot of the reviews and in descriptions of the band about being like stand-up comedians. What was it like being stuck behind the drums?
I always made sure that I had a microphone, which I hardly ever used to sing back up. It would just be like when everybody else is tuning up, I would say something. And there's been times when, you know, somebody breaks a string and I'll just walk up to the front of the stage and start using that mic too. We never set out to be like funny. We just had that New Jersey smart ass sense of humor that a lot of our friends have. And when we were on stage, there was just like a certain chemistry where, you know, sometimes like if a band is getting heckled from the audience, you know, they'd really, you know, cower up and just want to get on with their set as quick as possible. But we would relish it, you know. It's like, oh, you're going to heckle us, are you? Well, this is going to be fun. And, you know, we'd do like a Don Rickles on him and just, you know, turn it around so like the whole audience is laughing. And then, you know, there's other things like, you know, organic things. Like if a fight broke out, we would be able to stop the fight by just starting into some kind of stupid song that just went, fight, 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 kick him in the ball, dun, 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 and everybody would like fight, and everybody would start laughing at the fucking stop, you know?
Somehow, discussion about track number 15, Velvet Elvis, escaped my lists of questions to ask AOD. But since Velvet Elvis was a very kishy thing, in the 70s, and the 80s, and the 90s, and perhaps even today, I decided I'd spend this time talking about television and its effect on AOD and other bands in the 80s of its ilk.
Why was TV so important, or what was so influential about it that would seep into your music so apparently?
Well, we watched a lot of it. We grew up on it, especially the older shows. You know, a lot of shows were kind of campy, and we could appreciate that kind of value. Like Leave It to Beaver or Andy Griffith Show. I guess we looked at it different than a lot of people did.
Yeah, I mean, I experienced it too. We were only a few years after you, but we dealt with the same sort of incorporating these poppy TV show elements. But I'm still very curious as to why that time period, at least the early 80s to mid 80s, really sort of accented that, the comedy of TV.
I guess people were discovering more in the 80s that real life was totally opposite of what they showed on TV, especially for a white middle-class family, like the Brady Bunch. What fucking family acted like that? No fucking family did, you know? I come from a totally different fucking family. Totally opposite. Dysfunctional and, you know, alcoholism in the family. We were poor and we were fucked up. Watching the Brady Bunch as a kid, I'm like, wow, I wish I had a family like that. And then you grow up and you discover there is no fucking family like that. And so you laugh at it because it was such a fantasy world, you know, especially in the 50s, too, like with Leave It to Beaver, which Leave It to Beaver is a funny show. I think it's one of the funniest fucking shows. But, you know, shit, it didn't act like that. You know, all the fucked up shit they did, all the trouble they got into, you know, my old lady would smack me upside the fucking head on a daily basis just for saying something stupid. And if you went and did something stupid, holy shit, the ass kicking you would have got.
Track
I used to joke that I said there should be a genre called WORTV core because, you know, this is all before cable. So don't forget the amount of channels you had were limited. And a lot of us, we were all watching the same exact stuff. So, you know, if you can even chart, at least in the tri-state area, you can even look at a whole bunch of bands. Like, first, take the Dictators, you take the Ramones, you take us, you take the Beastie Boys, take the Misfits. We were all watching the same TV shows. We were all watching Carvel ice cream commercials. We were all watching, like, Castle commercials. We were watching Monster Week on the 4:30 movie with Godzilla. We were all watching Uncle Floyd. All those bands were influenced by it. I really don't even know if that's a thing anymore. Back then it was, you know. And that's why a lot of, and the Dickies, too, for a little West Coast flavor, they were covering, you know, TV theme songs and stuff. That was a huge influence on us. But like I say, in terms of the tri-state area, and I think that's also why we were so friendly with the whole Connecticut scene, too, because, you know, they were just on the other side of Manhattan, you know, we had so much in common with Connecticut, you know. It's that wise-ass suburban kind of thing going on, and a lot of that was informed by what we watched on TV growing up, you know.
Yeah, I just think it's fascinating, and I think it's one of those, because of the internet, it's sort of lost or is mutated into something other, like references. I don't want to downplay it, because I think there's actually a talent in finding the right TV show or the right reference to make an audience laugh, but it's sort of just making a recognition sort of laugh.
Yeah, it was like a language that we all shared, really.
You mentioned Uncle Floyd's show, but I don't think a lot of people know about that.
There's a local channel, like this little comedy sketch show, a half hour long, with Uncle Floyd, who's an entertainer, just wore these loud, mismatched suits. He played piano, and he had his cast of characters, just other local comedians or bums or potheads or whatever. Part kid show, part, you know, adults. The kids, there was stuff for kids, you know, like puppets and stuff. And it had pictures on the wall where kids, you know, send in pictures, or even old people send in pictures, and they'd hang them on the wall, and you get to see your picture there, and birthday wishes. And he also managed to have really cool bands on there. He had the Ramones on maybe 15, 20 times. And I think Squeeze was on there every time they came through. Misfits, bands, you know, big and small coming through in this little studio. It was really cool.
The Fuck the Neighbors, me and Paul wrote at my house in about 5 minutes. Paul came to my house, and he was pissed off at his neighbors. He's like, I fucking hate them. I want to write a song. So me and him sat down, wrote the lyrics and the music. I love the way that song came out on that record. Oh, I fucking love it. And I think the slow part was something we did right in the studio. I don't know if we really practiced it, you know, and then Bruce came up with that lead. I don't know if it's the greatest lead in the world, but it sounds fucking, it just fucking screams, you know, it just fucking screams. And then we blazed through that fucking song. Holy shit. I love it. It's one of my favorites. I'm the guy screaming at the end of that song too.
What is the relation from drums to guitars? Was your speed limited to what the others could play, or were their instruments equal in the increase in speed?
We played a lot. I mean, we would rehearse maybe like once a week, once every other week. There was a time like when we were doing at least one or two shows a weekend someplace, you know, New York, New Jersey. We would travel on weekend gigs to Boston and Philly and D.C. and Pittsburgh, Detroit. The more we played, the faster we got. I mean, I think that we always tried to play as fast as we could anyway. It's weird. I had listened to recently an interview with Dave Grohl on Mark Maron's WTF podcast, and we pretty much started the same way. It's kind of funny, with a big marching band pair of drumsticks and hitting a pillow before we had drums, you know, just playing along, you know, to all these songs that we liked on a pillow. I got those marching band sticks from John Bonham, because my sister was good friends with Zeppelin and Jimmy Page, and I got those sticks from him, and it was the only pair of sticks I had ever had. I never even thought about going out to buy a pair of sticks because I didn't have a drum, you know. It's kind of weird, but that's how I really got to play as fast as hell, was by starting off with these gigantic lumberjack trees of sticks. I didn't think that they made lighter sticks or thinner sticks, and when I started up, I still, you know, the first couple shows, I was still playing with these gigantic drumsticks. It's like lifting weights every day, you know, you just get faster and you get stronger and faster and stronger and faster and stronger. The first couple shows we did, I was in pain. I mean, the band would nickname me Absorbing Junior because after the show, I'd be having to wipe the stuff on my arms, cramps everywhere. It was terrible, but you know, the more you play, the faster you got.
I've read that Adrenaline OD had turned down quite a few offers from metal labels, including Combat Records. What does it mean for AOD to turn down these kind of offers? What does this say about an aesthetic difference between like punk and metal?
Well, we turned down offers from metal labels, number one, because we didn't consider ourselves a metal band. We are a punk band. We didn't want to be pushed into that metal vein. Not that we had anything against it. I loved the metal. You know, there was all that hair metal came out in the fucking 80s, and it was awful. Bands like Motorhead considers themselves punk, but to me, they were a metal band with a punk attitude. You know, but bands like Motorhead, Metallica, Anthrax, they fucking saved metal. But we weren't a metal band. Plus, with Bayer Records, we wanted to stay, you know, loyal to them. It was our label in the beginning, and it was all our friends. We were probably selling the most records on the label, and we didn't want to abandon that either.
For track 17, Surfin' Jew, you will now hear about House of Music Studio, starting with Paul, then Lenny, Bruce, David, and finally Jack.
Really, there was nothing to go by. You know, the engineers we're working with, like, they never heard anything like this. We're trying to set us up like a regular rock and roll band, and we start playing. They're like, okay. And they were, you know, clearly sympathetic. They had no idea what to do with us. We certainly had no idea what to do, so we just started, you know, twisting knobs, and that's what we came up with.
Hey, Moe, thanks up!
Like a vault, look at those waves!
The House of Music Studio. Give me a little bit about the studio itself and how you ended up there.
Recording studio in West Orange, which is a really nice kind of suburb, very close to where from Union. The House of Music had Jethro Tull, Kool and the Gang. They had like 10 people record at the studio, and a ferocious like hardcore punk band into a really slick studio like that. Everyone had to get used to everything. It was nice, the band liked it, but I guess the whole recording process was definitely probably a shock on both ends.
When we were in there the one time, we met Eddie Hendricks from The Temptations, which was awesome. And I think the Church were recording there at the same time we were recording there. People treated us awesome, and every single time we ordered a pizza and had it delivered, the pizza delivery guy was an AOD fan. And that started a whole, for about a good 3 years, I couldn't order a pizza without having the delivery guy be a fan of AOD.
The studio was pretty much the nicest and largest studio I'd ever been to. We had no business being there, and they would never have a band like us there, but the people that ran our record label worked out certain deals with the engineer so that when there was downtime, like late at night, and there was no session going on, we could come in and do our recording. Certain herbal supplements were exchanged, and we got night times in there, and that's how it started. All the records that have been recorded, they're all hanging on the walls, all the gold records. You just knew that, like, if somebody came in here, they'd ask for security for us to leave. You know, we ended up using that studio a few times with the label, so it turned out to be pretty good for us.
Jack, what do you remember of House of Music Studio?
Yeah, the one thing I remember is I went into the studio, and I like to drink. I like to get drunk. And I said, okay, I'm not going to drink while we're recording, while we're laying down the tracks. Well, when I got in there, they had a soda machine in there. I forget all different kinds of soda. But they also had two kinds of beer in the fucking soda machine. And it was free. So by the time we got ready to lay down tracks, I had 8 empty beer cans by my bass head because all the beer was free, which I thought was great.
Track 18, Bruce's Lament.
And to be honest with you, I haven't heard this record in decades. I never listened to it. I don't listen to any of that stuff. I think I might have listened to one or two things before the reunion show just to work out the kinks. I never listened to AMP at all. It's just too weird for me to do. I don't know.
Yeah, I can understand. I honestly, to tell you, I hadn't, until I decided I wanted to approach you guys, I hadn't listened to it in a while either. But once I put it back on, I love it again. I've been jogging to it, Bruce.
Oh, nice. Good for you. Wow. That's great. That was its intended use, so I'm glad that's working out for you. The hidden message and all that. Stay in shape.
So the other one that, yeah, like I said, your lyrics, it just seemed like an anthem for the band, but it's called Bruce's Lament. What's behind that? Was that, were you challenged to write a kudo for the band or an anthem?
I think I just took it upon myself, maybe. I don't know. I have no idea what inspired that. I do know. I think it was a bouncing soul song called Brian's Lament that they admitted that was a nod toward Bruce's Lament. But, other than that, I don't know, man. I have no idea. It was so long ago. Lost to the sands of time. I couldn't even tell you. I remember the lyrics being pretty stupid and funny, though. And it had an awesome mosh part in it. That's my only memory of that song, the awesome mosh part.
Lenny, you went on the road with AOD on the tour leading up to the recording of Humongous Fungus Among Us.
That was probably the best summer ever. Summer of 1985. And then we left in the end of May, and we didn't come home until mid-August. It was long. Most of the United States, 6 guys in a van with a little, I didn't even know if we had a U-Haul. We packed all the equipment in. Me and Frank from Bedlam. We helped out with everything, dragging the equipment in, setting up, selling the merch. The whole time, I think we were at all that time, we only went to 6 hotels. People would always want to take you home, let you trash in the house. That was a lot of fun. We stayed with people. Kids were at home, and their moms cooked dinner for us, and we washed our clothes there. It was kind of funny. It was really nice, but I got to remember, we were pretty much a bunch of polite kids. We might have had some haircuts and crazy t-shirts, but we were pretty much good kids and appreciative of all that. I always said my mother brought me up right. She gave me manners, so I don't have many things, but I'll have my manners. When they came back from that tour, they were so super tight. They're a great band, and I think they're very underappreciated in a lot of ways. They were overlooked by a lot of bands from that time. I think they were more popular out on the road than they were over here playing in their own backyard. The crowds in Jersey and New York at that time could be like either too lackadaisical or too cool to show to get likes out there. But on the road, I remember when they played in Las Vegas on that tour, people were rushing the stage like to the club fall. It was kind of crazy. It's like AOD's moment of Beatlemania.
Every record we did, like the last song in the record, for whatever reason, seemed to signal like the next record, like what we would sound like. And we ended Humongous with The Nice Song. And I think The Nice Song was the start of us kind of going back to our punk roots and more melodic. and which came on the next album, Cruising with Elvis. It was kind of like a precursor. I think, you know, in my opinion, The Nice Song is like one of my favorite songs that we've ever done. It's fun to play. It's a good sing-along. It's got great melody to it and it sticks in your head. And it's short, which is like everything I like about a good song.
Another thing I noticed listening to this, which I never really noticed before, I guess that's the clarity of digital mastering, is the background vocals for some of these songs. It's not even like a singing or anything. It's like this barking or this yelling out of something, this really gruff vocal. I just think is I never noticed before. That sounds really cool. Open the lungs, it's like, rah, rah. So I'm not saying anything. You just hear something in the background. Rah, rah. It really adds something. That's cool.
Why are you in Dave in dresses on the cover?
They're actually house coats.
House coats.
Yeah, and I always thought that myself. And you know what? I'm a fucking idiot. That's why. If somebody brought this shit and said, here, put this on, it'll be funny. And I just did like, oh, duh, okay. And then years later, I'm like, when the fuck did I put that shit on? And no other band would do that. Punk was about, you know, being individual and not following the masses and this and that. Then here got, you know, groups of people that dress all the fucking same. That I always thought went against what it was supposed to be about. But what are you going to do?
Bruce, lastly, I would like to know, what's up with that title, Humongous Fungus Among Us?
I think I came up with that. I'm not sure how or why. Just a bunch of words strung together. Probably just one of those weird late-at-night stoned revelations kind of deal, you know?
Were you on mushrooms?
No, I was not. I can't say that I was, actually. Those didn't come until several years later. I don't know what happened. It was just one of those things.
You came in on Wacky Hijinks, and then you probably went right into a tour, so this album was right in the midst of it.
We did do this one right after we got off the road, if I'm not mistaken. I know the one thing we made a conscious effort of doing was making the thank you list as long as humanly possible. I believe each of us had individual thanks. There were thank yous for the band. Oh, we were just thanking everyone. We just thought, let's thank as many people as possible and then give a list of reasons why we are so cool. I think that was one of my ideas, too. Let's give a handy list so everyone will know why we are cool, and then they could just bust those out when need be, you know?
In case they need to prove it to their friends.
In case someone calls them, these guys are not cool. Give me a reason. I have several reasons right here in front of me. So we were helpful. We were trying to help. That's what this record is all about, helping others.
Thank you for listening to episode 12 of Jughead's Basement, Adrenaline OD's Humongous Fungus Among Us. Stay tuned for upcoming podcasts featuring Big Black, Crimp Shrine, and Angry Samoans.
Thank you for listening to Jughead's Basement right here at jugheadsbasement.com. If you'd like to help keep the show free every month, click the donate button and give as much or as little as you can. If you'd like to lend your talents to the show and help John edit future episodes, send an email to jugheadsbasement@gmail.com. The show is also available on iTunes, so take a moment, write us a review. We'll see you next time.